Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 17, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon, and welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today's call is on regulating the regulators, the North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners versus Federal Trade Commission case at the U.S. Supreme Court. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts on the call. The first is Professor Rebecca Hall Allensworth from Vanderbilt University Law School, and the second is Misha Saitlin, who is the Deputy Attorney General at the Office of the West Virginia Attorney General. More complete bios for our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. And we're going to go ahead and start off with Professor Allensworth, so the floor is yours.
Thank you. So obviously we're brought here by the case that was argued on Tuesday in front of the Supreme Court, North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners versus the FTC. And in it, the Supreme Court is set to resolve a circuit split. Essentially, the question is, how close of a relationship must you have with the state to be considered part of the state for state action immunity under the antitrust laws? The FTC argues, and I think they're right, that private actors personally, financially interested in the very licensing regime that they're supposed to be implementing, and ones that are totally unsupervised, are not entitled to state immunity. A little bit on the case. So the board is made up, as many licensing boards are in the U.S., by a majority of practicing professionals licensed in their field. These dentists decided that teeth whitening is a part of dental practice, and therefore a bunch of teeth whiteners in North Carolina were not acting pursuant to their regulations of needing to be licensed to engage in dentistry. And they sent a bunch of cease and desist letters out to these teeth whiteners. Now, to somebody who studies professional licensing in the U.S., this is not surprising. Teeth whiteners represented competition to those dentists. In fact, a disheartening number of boards in the states are comprised of a majority, usually a supermajority, of licensed professionals. So I actually wrote an article about licensing boards, comparing them to cartels, with my co-author, Aaron Edlin. And we found that in Tennessee and Florida, over 90% of the boards are made up of a majority of currently practicing professionals. This is justified by the idea that we need experts to be regulating the professions. But this creates a fox guarding the henhouse problem, and where you have self-regulation, you have self-dealing. Licensing is also on the march. In the 50s, about 1 in 20 workers needed a license to do their job. Now that number is more like 1 in 3, which means that 33% of workers in the U.S. must have a license to legally practice their trade or their craft. Where it used to be limited to what we would call the learned professions, now we're seeing shampooers, flower arrangers, hair braiders, interior designers, and fortune tellers in some states needing licenses to work. And even where it is appropriate, so for those doctors and lawyers, the learned professions, I would argue that those restrictions often go way too far. And the impact on consumers is significant. Licensing tends to raise prices as much as 20%. And some economists have estimated the cost to consumers at about $100 billion a year. Whether or not this licensing actually improves quality is a more difficult question, but it seems like the research here is sort of equivocal. So getting back to the case, after the board sent these cease and desist letters, the FTC brought suit under the Sherman Act, saying it had violated Section 1. And the board claimed that it had state action immunity and so was not subject to this suit. But there's a line of cases saying that if the state chooses to delegate regulation to private actors, they must do so. They must also be supervised by the state itself. So if you want to have private actors regulating an industry, you need to supervise them in order to enjoy antitrust immunity. That's the Mid-Cal test. It has two prongs. Now, there's a bit of a shortcut for public entities. For public entities, they don't need supervision. This is what a case called Halley decided by the Supreme Court says. So the essential dispute in the case is a board like the dentistry board public or private? And likewise, this was basically the focus of oral argument on Tuesday. The dentist suggested, well, this is up to the state. If the state calls it an agency, then it is public and so does not need supervision. But the problem is that the case that sort of started the whole immunity back in the 40s in Parker, the Supreme Court said, the state does not give immunity to those who violate the Sherman Act by authorizing them to violate it. So it can't be the test that the state can just say, this is part, they are part of us and therefore do not need the supervision to enjoy immunity. The dentist then offered, well, they can wear two hats. They can be private actors some of the time when they're working in their dentistry practice, and they can be public actors when they're regulating. He suggested that the lawyer for the dentist suggested that the fact that they swore an oath to the state was enough to separate them from the private entities that would need supervision. And I think appropriately, none of the justices seemed particularly moved by that argument that the oath makes the difference. I think Justice Kagan hit the nail on the head when she said, look, we have this odd entity, we have private actors that the state is calling a public agency, and we need to have a test for separating out whether or not this board is more like a private entity or more like a public entity. And that answer comes from whether or not that board is likely to act in their own self-interest. Something she said in this case was sort of self-evidently true, and I agree. Where that is true, you need the tandem effect of MidCal. You need both the authorization from the state and you need the state's supervision. If they're private and they have authorization from the state, and when we say private, we mean extremely self-interested, there's no confidence that they would actually be acting in furtherance of the state policy. That's why you need the supervision. They kind of work in tandem. And I think some of the justices really emphasized that on Tuesday. There was a lot of concern in oral argument about federalism. The dentist argued that the affirming this case would mean that the federal government could invasively mandate a certain particular regulatory regime for the states. They had, you know, sort of the feds coming in and saying, this is how you have to regulate states, and that violated federalism. There was also some concern that what this would mean is that experts would be ousted from regulation entirely. So Justices Breyer and Scalia seemed especially worried about whether or not brain surgery could be regulated not by brain surgeons but by a bunch of bureaucrats. Unfortunately, from my perspective, the government's lawyer didn't provide the crispest answer to this these concerns. But it's really rather simple. The law says that if the state chooses to use financially interested market actors to regulate, and if the state does not want that board to be subject to antitrust, then it has to supervise them. That actually gives them a lot of options. They can hire experts full time to work as civil servants who are not also wearing the hat of the interested private actor. They can do that with a retired dentist, for example, who've given up their license, or they can supervise a board of interested market participants, or they can just allow the antitrust suits to go forward. And what I would expect is, under the rule of reason, many of the restrictions that boards pass would pass with flying colors. It's only the extreme and the anti-competitive, as perhaps in this case, that wouldn't make it, and that's all to the good from my perspective. So in conclusion, I feel optimistic about the court affirming, especially after hearing oral argument on Tuesday, and I think that's the right outcome. I am disturbed by one detail. At least Justice Scalia seemed interested in the fact that this board was somewhat unusually, as it turns out, elected by other dentists, so elected by other market participants with the same self-interest. And I agree with Scalia that that makes their self-interest even worse. But the truth is that most boards in the U.S. are appointed by the governor, even if they are majority market participants with self-interest. What that means is that if the court were to narrow its holding by saying that boards that are A, made up of market participants, and B, elected by other market participants, don't enjoy state action immunity without that supervision, the holding would have virtually no effect on licensing in the U.S. And I think that would be unfortunate. And so I would hate to see the Fourth Circuit affirmed on narrow grounds. I'm hoping that the court goes forward and affirms on the idea that it's the status of the board members, not how they got there, that determines their self-interest. Thanks.
All right. Misha Salen, you're up.
Thank you for having me on. I'm honored to be part of this Federal Society conference call. I've been a Federal Society member for more than a decade, ever since I joined back at Georgetown Law when I was running the Georgetown Law Federal Society chapter. So I'm thrilled to be part of this call. We here at the West Virginia Attorney General's Office filed an amicus brief in support of the Dental Board on behalf of a bipartisan coalition of 23 states. First, I want to give a quick overview of what the issue here is, in my mind at least. North Carolina, like every other state in the union, regulates dentists through a board of dentistry. Like the vast majority of these states, North Carolina staffs its board with actively practicing dentists on the notion that these actively practicing folks know more about dentistry than career bureaucrats. Numerous states throughout the country follow a similar model for regulating other professions, such as doctors. The basic question in this case is whether federal antitrust law punishes the admittedly anti-competitive actions of such regulatory boards unless and until the state also appoints career bureaucrats to actively supervise the board's actions. So basically, do federal antitrust laws require two layers of state bureaucracy involved in professional regulation rather than just one? Given the probable audience of this call, I'm going to assume that we generally share a couple of premises. First, we are textualists. We believe in interpreting a law as written and as understood by those at the time it was written and adopted. Second, we do not believe the federal government has any authority under the U.S. Constitution to tell states how to staff their own state agencies. Taking these two premises as givens, this case should be an exceptionally easy one. When the Sherman Antitrust Act was enacted in 1890, the act outlawed private actions that restrained or monopolized trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations. That's still the text today. No one in 1890 thought a state's regulation of professions such as dentists operating within a state's borders had anything to do with trade among states or foreign nations. Unfortunately, when the Supreme Court extended the notion of interstate commerce in infamous cases such as Wickard, the court also determined through judicial construction to also extend the reach of the Sherman Act without any textual or originalist basis. This created a dilemma for state sovereignty because much of state regulation of intrastate business can be seen as a restraint on trade, for it surely is. So what the Supreme Court said in Parker versus Brown was to recognize that even with the Sherman Act being extended by virtue of the Commerce Clause jurisprudence, states and their officials remained free from antitrust liability for doing what they have always done, both before and after Sherman, regulating professions within their borders. Under these premises and history, this case should be an easy one. North Carolina has decided to regulate dentists operating within its borders and has decided to accomplish that end in a traditional way, staffing its regulatory board with active professionals. It has not tried to accomplish some sort of sham legislation to allow its dentists to avoid federal antitrust law. Therefore, the federal antitrust laws have nothing to say about North Carolina's sovereign choices. Now, I recognize this case is not seen as an easy one to many folks who normally share the premises I just laid out. And I think that's only really for one reason and one reason only. Many of us share a healthy, and I think correct, skepticism of regulatory boards and professional licensure as a policy matter. I worked with folks at Institute for Justice before I took this job, working against anti-competitive professional licensure regimes, and deeply share many of these same concerns. I read Professor Allensworth's recent article about the many abuses of professional licensure, and many of her comments on this call had me nodding in agreement. But this is not an economic liberties case, where the underlying regulation is being challenged as infringing the right to earn a living under the Due Process Clause or the Privileges or Immunities Clause. This is a case about whether when states use active professionals to staff regulatory boards, those states must also add an additional layer of bureaucratic regulation to supervise those boards. I take it that those whose beliefs are generally against professional licensure are not really fighting for an additional layer of bureaucracy within the licensure process. I know that's never been my goal. And even if one believes the extra layer of bureaucrats is, all things considered, a good idea, And I'm skeptical that a second layer of bureaucracy would cure any of the ills Professor Ellsworth articulated here. We should remember that when we talk about the importance of federalism, state sovereignty, we are espousing deep constitutional principles. These are not, as our friends on the left charge, a facade simply to oppose federal policies we don't like Obamacare or EPA overreach, which we are quick to discard when we find a rare area where the federal government's involvement in state governments forwards a policy we like. Instead, they are deep core principles that we support regardless of the particular policy ends at issue. A final word on the arguments that took place on Tuesday before the Supreme Court. Most of the reporting I've seen predicts that the North Carolina Dental Board will lose the case. I'm not so sure. The questions were pretty skeptical of both sides, and I think the justices recognized difficult line-drawing problems under the current doctrine, no matter what approach the court decided to go with. Justice Kennedy in particular was concerned about the practical chilling impact on individuals willing to serve on regulatory boards if they are threatened with treble damages as part of federal antitrust law, a point we emphasized in our amicus brief. But I was struck particularly by one exchange at the court arguments that I think highlights why the FTC is exactly wrong here. Justice Alito asked the FTC's counsel if everything would be peachy if the state staffed the board with retired dentists, and the counsel said, that would be a legitimate way of staffing. I would hope that most everyone on this call can see that the federal antitrust law's prohibition against restraints of trade among the states is not a warrant for the FTC to determine what is a, quote, legitimate way for a state to staff its own agencies. But the position espoused by the supporters of the FTC necessarily leads to that result. Thank you.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. I think we can go ahead and start getting people in line for questions. So we'll now open the floor. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And and while we're waiting for questions to come on, I want to give Professor Ellsworth, do you want to take a couple minutes to respond to anything that you heard there?
Yeah, I appreciate what Misha had to say, and there are a few points of agreement, but of course more of disagreement. One thing that I think I take issue with is the idea that that there was an expansion of Sherman Act liability to the states, and that this line of cases that has cropped up is sort of a bulwark against that expansion, and the expansion itself is illegitimate and sort of wasn't even considered in 1890 when they passed the law. Well, that sort of begs the question, right? Because nobody wants to extend the Sherman Act to the state. That's what state action immunity is. The question here is, what is the state? And since Parker says, and I think reasonably, the state can't just authorize a cartel and walk away, we have to come up with some sort of test for what is a cartel and what is legitimately part of the state. And that, I think, if you see it that way, and this is something that Kagan said, Justice Kagan said in oral argument, it becomes a more difficult question. And this is where we have to draw some difficult lines. It's not possible to simply say, this is the state gets immunity, and have that be a principled way, unless we are willing to just let those words of Parker sort of be overruled, I guess, that the states can't just call a cartel part of the state and then let them regulate.
All right. Misha, any? Do you want to rebut that at all, or do you want to move on to questions?
I'll just quickly say that the way I read the words of Parker is that the state can't, as a sham, set up immunity to federal antitrust. You know, if there's a cartel that's already violating federal antitrust law, the state can't go ahead and bless that. I don't take those words of Parker to mean that the mine-run regency boards that are staff-backed professionals are somehow foreboding by federal antitrust law.
All right. Well, we do have one question on the line, and then our lines will be open, so we'll go to our first question now.
This is David Oshani from Columbus, Ohio. Some of the reports that I've read and heard seem to suggest that the justices were sort of struggling with trying to find a way to resolve this issue, but not open up sort of Pandora's box by potentially calling into question all state regulatory boards. And I read that Justice Ginsburg seemed to focus some of her questions on the fact that the North Carolina State Dental Board of Examiners issued cease and desist orders, letters, that were actually beyond the board's authority. You know, oftentimes when a state agency, a regulatory agency, licensing agency, believes that someone is practicing without a license, they take that information to a local prosecutor and have law enforcement follow up. They don't actually, you know, they regulate the licensees. Someone who doesn't have a licensee, they don't necessarily take action against. So I was wondering, is that a possible scenario that could cobble a majority together to say, we don't even have to reach this broader issue of whether immunity applies to state agencies, because here you have an entity that was acting beyond its authority, state immunity does not apply in this situation because it was a agency that was acting beyond its legitimate authority. Is that a possible scenario?
So Justice Ginsburg did raise that question. I think it would be pretty odd for the Supreme Court to avoid that case based on an issue of state law. You know, I suppose it's possible that the Supreme Court could certify the question to the North Carolina Supreme Court as to the scope of the agency's authority, but I would find that to be surprising.
And I share. Go ahead.
Right. That's it.
Oh, I was going to say, I share Misha's reaction. I think that the only way that they could do that would be to say that I also read that by the question by Justice Ginsburg, and I was puzzled because it seems like the only way that they could do that would be to say that they didn't have the first prong of Mid-Cal, which is the articulation but from the state, the authority to act in this anti-competitive way, a clear articulation of an intent to abrogate the competitive policy of the Sherman Act. And it seems to me like the board definitely does have that clear articulation. Any restriction on dentistry would affect the competitive environment. And I also understand there's an underlying dispute as to whether or not the letters were worded as sort of self-executing injunctions, which is what they don't have the authority to do, or a threat to sue, which they do have the authority to do. So this is something that I didn't figure prominently in any of the cases below and any of the reasonings of the Fourth Circuit. So I think it's very unlikely to be the grounds of the decision.
Thank you.
All right. Any other thoughts?
Well, I something that Misha said that trying to draw this line between what's public and what's private, he offered the idea that sham delegation would not be allowed, and that's sort of what's meant by Parker. And you offered as an example a cartel that's existing. I agree that would be sort of an extreme case of sham, but who's to say that this isn't a sham? Who's to say that handing over the reins to the very participants of their own competition and saying, you get to decide who's in, you get to decide how we practice, you get to decide the terms of competition. That sounds to me an awful lot like a sham. And when we think about what Congress intended in 1890 or even what the court meant in the 40s when it decided Parker, the reach of professional licensing and what it would look like today could not have been on their minds. And I think if it had been brought to their attention, they might have seen that as a sham. So the trouble, I think, is coming up with a workable test for what is sham and what is not. And that's where I think that the sort of overriding self-interest of the regulators in terms of actually being private licensed individuals is where I'm prepared to draw that line.
Well, so I think inherent – no, thank you for those comments. I think inherent in the notion of sham is that it's something exceptional, that it's something done particularly, I think, to evade the federal antitrust laws. I think it would be hard to argue that doing what, you know, is done by every state – I think 49 out of 50 states have dentistry boards that are staffed by active professionals – that that is some sort of sham to avoid – federal antitrust law is not accurate. I think it's just the way it's done. And I think it's done that way, you know, for some laudable reasons, like the expertise of active dentists, and perhaps for some less laudable reasons, anti-competitive reasons. But I think those anti-competitive reasons are completely the policies of those states. I think it's hard to believe that when a state creates a dentistry board, it's not trying to have an anti-competitive result. They think that it's worth it because of the public interest. And then once we recognize that, I think we have to recognize that the attacks, like the ones in this case, are not really attacks meant to ensure that what is going on here is really the policy of the state. I think it's kind of a second-best policy by people, among myself, I'll include that among myself, that are frustrated that you can't bring economic liberties challenges to the substantive nature of, you know, shutting down people for being teeth whiteners. And so people are trying to use second best principles, and the results of the second best principles, I think, are third best results, which is to encourage two layers of bureaucracy and to drive the best of the people who would serve on these boards away from them.
So, yeah, thank you for those comments. And one thing I'd like to highlight is that I too am concerned about the economic liberty angle here and the unfortunate seeming lack, although there's some cracks in this doctrine now too as well, of redress for the individual practitioners. But I don't think that makes antitrust a second best, because there's at least two sets of interests that we care about when it comes to overregulation of the professions. That's the professionals themselves and the consumer. And our research and the research of an economist named Morris Kleiner at University of Minnesota shows that the consumers are getting the short end of the stick here in a significant way in terms of dollar amount per year, in terms of choice. And that's a central concern and the proper concern of the antitrust laws. And I don't see the due process or equal protection style litigation, which, you know, is sort of weak for doctrinal reasons anyway, as even addressing that. So I think antitrust is, you know, I don't want to say that it's first best and that the individual liberties are second best, but they stand shoulder to shoulder against abuse of licensing regulation, and they both sort of concern different but very legitimate, very important concerns.
All right. Well, we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key.
Good afternoon. This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you both for an excellent presentation, and I don't want to get you too far off of the case, but having studied and worked at this, do you see any other solution other than a federal solution that would be aimed at limiting or preventing all of the regulatory capture and the other limiting behavior of all of the rentiers that are trying to limit competition? And when you started out and described some of the, I think it was Professor Allensworth, listed some of the occupations that are regulated by this means. And I just looked real quickly on one state's list, and besides shampooers, I personally remember some disputes about guys that float horses' teeth. They're not veterinarians.
Yep.
There's the hair braiders, fishing guides in that state, limousines, manicurists, equine chiropractors, you mentioned fortune tellers, household goods movers, kickboxing promoters. I mean, there's no limit to the area in which, Mr. Taslin said, is it ripe for the Institute for Justice to be trying to limit these anti-competitive practices? What other solutions do you see, if not this case?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. First, the the most primary solution in a democracy is always to vote for people in your state that will not have these kinds of things, if that is what you prefer. And I think most everybody on the call recognizes that there are significant abuses that we need to stop. Second, reinvigoration of privileges or immunities or due process litigation. That's another step that could be taken. I do think, and I apologize for repeating myself, I do think that this case and the rule being urged by this case will have no beneficial effects with regard to these problems. The professor mentioned some studies with regard to the negative effect of the growth of professional licensure on consumer welfare, and I think those studies are well-grounded. But I think there are no studies that I'm aware of that say that a second layer of bureaucrats supervising these regulatory boards, a second layer that could be subject to its own capture, would in any way ameliorate those harmful effects. So as much as we may dislike professional licensure's abuses, we should be very careful not to jump on every case where a professional licensure board is on the other side of the V. We should carefully examine what the practical effects of that will be, not only in the policy areas at issue, but also for broader principles that I discussed earlier, like originalism, textualism, federalism.
So I agree, again, with what Mr. Salen is saying about the importance of reinvigorating the constitutional protections here. I think that's really important, and I think that that's, when you have a problem of this size, of this magnitude, you're going to start seeing hydraulic pressure against precedents that are outdated, that don't anticipate and sort of adequately respond to this problem. And I think you see that on the constitutional side happening in several different jurisdictions, thanks in part to the work of the Institute for Justice. So I applaud that, and I would love to see this problem be tackled from both sides. One thing that Mr. Salen said that that I take issue with is the idea that voting and a democracy will help alleviate this problem. And it's not that I disagree with that. It's that that's why I want to see the active supervision happen. I want to see the states take responsibility for the regulations that are passed by expert boards, if indeed they decide to use industry experts in the form of currently licensed practitioners. That would sort of close the democratic loop. He calls it a second layer of bureaucracy, but what I see it as is the state actually taking responsibility, something beyond just an imprimatur, for that regulation in a way that would force them to be accountable, force them to be accountable to the voters for the kinds of anti-competitive regulations that are being passed. And to that extent, perhaps create an incentive for them not to allow such anti-competitive regulations to be passed because they know that the voters don't want it. I think the bottom line is that people don't want this. I hear nothing but outrage, similar to the gentleman who called in, about the extent of professional licensing and just how far out of hand it's gotten. So it seems like there's something that's amiss here in the democracy, and I think the missing link is that supervision between the expert board and the state itself.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we had three questions jump on the line, so we'll go right to those.
Hi, my name is Jeff Hymans, and I was a former Assistant Attorney General in Washington State who did some antitrust work, and I had a couple of questions. One, a lot of licensing boards are mixed boards with a number of either private citizens or non-professionals added, and I was wondering for Professor Hall whether she thinks that, for example, any board with more than 50% of licensed individuals would require antitrust scrutiny, whereas, for example, boards with less than 50% might not. My second question regards other boards like commodities boards, which levy fees to promote certain commodities in certain states, and whether or not there are antitrust implications for those boards if they include commodities producers, which almost all of them do. And my third question is whether or not a decision in the current case could allow an attack on licensing boards which operate in disciplinary procedures. For example, in Washington State, three dentists would sit in judgment of another dentist accused of unprofessional conduct, would a decision applying antitrust to licensing boards allow a subject dentist to challenge a disciplinary proceeding in federal court and conduct discovery on, for example, the issue of the motive of the three dentists who were serving as in a disciplinary role? And so I'll just leave those three questions for answered by the folks. Thanks.
Yeah, I think that the words that the FTC used about how many self-interested licensed professionals is too many on a board is a decisive coalition, and I think that that's similar to some phrasing that I used in my article with Professor Edlin. And I think that's right. I think that the way the boards typically are constituted now are mostly licensed self-interested actors with nominal representation from a consumer or another type of constituent, and I think that that could be reversed. I think you could have a situation where you had a majority of other types of interests represented, and then you have a minority of the professionals. The professionals could be there to provide their expert opinion, and the board might benefit from that. But in that circumstance, you wouldn't be as worried about the self-interest problem and would not be subject to the supervision prong. I think that's right. Now, where exactly that line is drawn as far as how close to a majority do they have to have voting rights, et cetera, that's something that is sort of beyond anything I can be specific enough about now. But, yeah, I think the major problem is it's a decisive coalition. A decisive coalition, to me, means majority. So I think that would be yet another another option the state would have in avoiding antitrust liability here. As far as the commodities boards, I think so I'm not as familiar with commodities regulation as I am with professional regulation. But to me, it strikes me that although you say that the boards are majority commodities producers, they're probably not all commodities producers of the same commodity. So if there was a wheat board where everybody is a wheat farmer, I might say that the same analysis applies. But if they're not direct competitors of each other, so wheat versus I'm not that familiar with commodities, but, you know, rice. I don't know if we grow rice in America. I'm sure we do. Versus a soybean, then you're not going to have that kind of decisive majority that troubles me. In fact, when we see in Parker, the sort of original state action immunity case, there was a farmer's board passing a regulation about raisins, and only one of the members of the board was a raisin farmer. To me, that's part of why that board was entitled to immunity. And as to your last question, again, this is not my area of expertise. I believe what you're talking about is sometimes called peer review.
For example, in many states, dental boards have the ability to revoke the license of another dentist who is accused of unprofessional conduct.
Right.
And oftentimes, these dental boards who pass general regulations sit in subsets of the dental boards, in subsets of, for example, three members of the dental boards, to hear a case brought against a dentist practicing in that state. And I was wondering whether the decision in favor of applying antitrust scrutiny would allow challenging in federal court an ongoing administrative proceeding as, you know, potentially being violative of antitrust law, and inquiring, for example, by discovery or by deposition into the motive of the three dentists who may have been assigned from the dental board to serve as a disciplinary panel.
Okay, thank you. That does clarify the question for me. And to me, it's a difference that was pointed up in the oral argument on Tuesday that I didn't really fully understand why they were making such a big deal out of the difference. The difference between a board passing a universally applicable rule and then a board passing on individual fitness of a particular licensed individual. There seemed to be some discussion in oral argument that these were competitively different. I don't see them that way. I mean, you can sort of imagine that a universally applicable rule will have a larger anti-competitive effect, whereas getting rid of one individual dentist has lesser. That seems sort of obvious to me. But both of them have the potential to restrict competition, and I do think they should both be subject to the same analysis. So in other words, whatever the board is doing that restricts competition would be part of the same discussion of what they get immunity for, what they don't get immunity for. Now, as for the question about whether or not you'd be able to get discovery on the motivation, I don't think that sounds appropriate to me at all. Rather, it would be what you would have to do is if you were going to have a majority of dentists deciding the fate of this particular dentist who has a lot of complaints or has some issues with the board, you would have to do it in a way that wasn't decided by a majority of his competitors. That's sort of a basic principle of antitrust law, in my opinion, that you don't have the competitors deciding who's in and who's out. And so you'd either procedurally fix that by having other interested people, not self-interested, not financially interested, be involved in that decision, or you would have that decision be appealable to some, what Mr. Salen calls a second level of bureaucracy, and I would call it the first level of bureaucracy, to see if that decision is competitively suspect or if it indeed seems to be a problem with this particular practitioner's safety record.
So, I mean, I would just add that everything that was said there seems like an accurate account of what the FTC's position would be, and I find it very troubling. It turns the text of the Sherman Act, which I read before, into basically a charter for the FTC to tell states how to set up their disciplinary proceedings. And it gets worse than that. Imagine if you are a dentist that just wants to do a good job in deciding whether a particular other dentist was abusive. And imagine if you're in a state that hasn't adopted the FTC manual for good state governance. In order to do your duty to try to decide whether a particular dentist has done something horribly unethical, you have to risk the danger of a federal antitrust suit. And while that may not involve discovery into your subjective motives, under the Supreme Court's decision in Omnia probably wouldn't, it would potentially subject you to treble damages, attorney's fees, potential criminal liability. Why risk it? Why would any good professional take that risk? The best people wouldn't refuse to serve on those boards. And that, I think, is a very bad policy outcome beyond being just not possibly contemplated by the text of the Sherman Act.
I just want to further, though, that remember, subjecting your regulations to antitrust scrutiny is just one option that the state would have. Supervision would be another. Changing the format of the board would be another.
All right. Well, we've got a little over about 15 minutes left, and we have two questions on the line, so we should have time to get to both of those as well as maybe one more. We'll go right to our next question.
Hi, this is Chad Radler, also in Columbus, Ohio. You sort of answered my question already a little bit, and perhaps it depends on what exactly the Supreme Court holds if it rules against the dental board. But if it does rule against the dental board, what are the immediate impacts on the board in terms of makeup or selection? Is that going to be dramatically changed sort of overnight? And two, I take it this impacts not only dental boards, but medical boards, pharmacy boards, and a whole host of regulatory boards that virtually every state uses. I just was kind of curious about since there's some suggestion that maybe the dental board would lose, what are the immediate impacts that these boards are going to face?
Well, you know, for many of these boards, including many boards in the state of West Virginia here, their composition and all of the other accoutrements around them, the level of bureaucratic oversight, are legislatively determined. So any response to an adverse Supreme Court decision would have to involve legislation. In the meanwhile, I would guess that you would have boards that would have resignations, you'd have boards that would basically stop operations until there was some state legislation. I think it would be very disruptive depending on how broadly the opinion was written. If the opinion was written narrowing only to boards that are also voted upon by active professionals, that probably would have a lesser effect just because there are less boards that are elected in that way.
To my mind, if the prediction is that people will stop serving on boards, that almost serves as an indictment of their intentions in serving on the boards. So what this holding would mean to me is that naked professional protectionism is not going to be as easy or as tolerated as it has been. That shouldn't affect the board member who intends to preserve the sort of safety and integrity of the profession. I don't think we can know exactly what will happen. I think that there will be some state legislation changing either the various options that states have to change the makeup of the board, change the review procedures, and all that I see to the good. Let's not forget that this is an FTC case, this particular case, and so if the court rules against the dental examiners in this case, they will not be subject to treble damages. So this seems like a good case to hold against the board and send the message that Supreme Court law doesn't allow this kind of essentially delegating regulation to a cartel and walking away.
All right. Well, we've got now we've got two questions on the line. We'll go to both of those. We'll go over the first one right now. Hello, are you with us?
Hi. The mute button didn't unmute. The most libertarian solution to certifying professionals is to have certification marks that could be enforced voluntarily by certification mark law, trademark law, so that people like or organizations like CSA or the Steam Fitter certifiers or Underwriters Laboratories would certify the safety of the practitioner. The placement of this into compulsory licensing, where only one type of qualification is required for any given service, like medical services, it just invites this sort of abuse. The fact that antitrust law can be used against this thing is a good thing, particularly good since monopolies that are free market based tend to be much less abusive than coercive monopolies that are created by the state, such as these licensing bodies, or utility laws which don't allow competitors to power supplies or electrical power or water or cable or communications or telephone. So the antitrust law would be a very good way to do it, except for this silly exception for state action. And it's particularly silly that the state action can be designed as an anti-competitive scheme. I think what we have to do is push more toward the libertarian solution of voluntary certification and try to delegitimize state action for licensing. And this has gotten much more plausible since you are required to get a license to braid hair and to inspect houses and to buff fingernails.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, I consider myself a libertarian, and as a policy matter, what you've articulated would be stuff that I would generally support. But I think I would just ask everyone whose instincts are that way on this call to just think about for a second. If you really believe the federal government would have a legitimate interest and a legitimate right under the Commerce Clause to regulate the local practice of teeth whitening in some local mall that has nothing to do with interstate commerce, I think almost everyone here that is like-minded would say no, that is outside of the bounds of what the Commerce Clause authority is. And we should not abandon those principles when the federal law is trying to achieve a policy ends that we agree with as a general matter.
So a couple of things that the caller brought up that I wanted to highlight, and that's the observation that I think something he called a coercive monopoly or a government monopoly being more powerful than an ordinary cartel. This is absolutely true. So these state licensing boards, in my paper, we analyze, we sort of analogize it to cartels, analogize the board to a cartel. But, of course, it's much stronger than that. It's much more powerful than an ordinary cartel because they actually have the power to prevent cheating on the cartel. They have the power to regulate entry. They have they lack a lot of the weaknesses that an ordinary cartel has. So it's worth thinking about just how strong and how powerful these boards are. And another point brought up by the caller that I think is really worth emphasizing is this idea that certification may be a better way to regulate here. It would be a much less heavy-handed way to do it. So the way you could do certification would either be through a private certifying body, or even you could certify through the state. What this would mean is you could claim to have this certification, and that would help you get customers and sort of communicate your reputation, but it wouldn't make it illegal to practice without a certification. That's essentially the distinction between certification and licensing, and this is something that the economist Morris Kleiner emphasizes in his research, too. This would be a lot less anti-competitive while addressing some of the issues that licensing is meant to address, which is the informational asymmetry as between the consumer and the provider. So I agree wholeheartedly with the caller about the importance of certification, and I imagine that if the Supreme Court does decide against the dentists and affirms the FTC, I imagine we will see some of these boards, some of the really extreme ones, like maybe perhaps the teeth floaters and the fortune tellers, maybe those boards will stop doing licensing and rather opt in favor of something like a certification scheme.
All right, well, we've got about 5 minutes left for questions, and we've got one more question on the line that we'll go to.
Hi, my name is Alan Dixler. I'm an attorney in New Jersey. And first of all, I think this has been a really valuable and interesting conversation. My thoughts wandered to, well, how does this apply to the state's regulation of attorneys? Now, typically that is done through the state Supreme Courts. Those courts typically are comprised of lawyers. I mean, most of the attorneys on the highest court, or most of the judges on the highest court are trained in lawyers and are admitted to the bar. And it made me wonder about that. Particularly when there are committees on the unauthorized practice or unlicensed practice of law, how does this affect where the line is drawn when an out-of-state attorney does something that affects or potentially crosses state lines? It seems to me that typically the rules concerning the practice of law often seem to be, quite frankly, incumbent protection.
That's a great question. The regulation of lawyers is slightly different from the way that most professions are regulated in the U.S., and it does have to do with the Supreme Court of each state acting in a sort of quasi-regulatory board capacity, and that makes the analysis different. Under the state action doctrine, it's relatively uncontroversial that entities of the state as sovereign, so that would be the governor, it would be the legislature, and it would be the Supreme Court, get immunity as a matter of course. They don't have to pass this test about articulation or supervision. And so that affords the regulation of the legal profession significantly more protection. I, like you, see that as being unfortunate. What that will mean for this case is that it may not have a lot This case may not have a lot to say with how we regulate the lawyers. This was also a question that Justice Scalia asked in oral argument, so I share your concern, but I think it applies less directly to lawyers than it does to other professions, although I'd be interested if Mr. Salen has a different analysis.
No, I agree with that. I think, it would be unlikely that whatever rule comes out here of this will apply to state Supreme Courts.
All right. Well, we'll do one last call for questions. We've got a few minutes left, so star and then the pound key if you want to jump in for one last question of our experts. All right. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both of our experts today for joining us for a great discussion. Thank you to our audience for calling in and listening and for your excellent questions. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. A reminder that you can find the podcast of this teleforum conference call as well as the rest of our calls on our website at fedsoc.org, where you can stream or download those podcasts. And we look forward to seeing you on our calls next week. So until then, we're adjourned, and thank you all again very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.